You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on February 18th, 2024. I'm going to start with the talk section of the magazine. The interviewer, as usual, is David Marchese. The title is Marilynn Robinson Considers Biden a Gift of God. There's a picture right next to the headline. She's wearing a soft turtleneck sweater. It's blue, long gray hair down to the middle of her back, blue-gray eyes, and she's looking off to the left without smiling. She seems peaceful. The celebrated writer discusses human freedom, immortality, and the stinginess that has... And the stinginess that has settled into the country. And David writes, for years, I had a second-hand paper book copy of Marilynn Robinson's 1980 novel, Housekeeping, on my bookshelf that I never got around to reading. Then one day I picked it up. Not altogether too long later, I put it down, finished. In the plain smokiness of its language, the grace and dignity of its characters, the simplicity of its story and its intimations of spiritual transcendence, Housekeeping is a book that transformed how I see my place in the world. And I'm not alone. Former President Barack Obama has talked about how Robinson's work influenced him. Robinson, who for years taught at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, hasn't given us a new novel since Jack in 2020, but she does have a new nonfiction book that we published next month. Reading Genesis is, as the title suggests, Robinson's literary analysis of the first book of the Old Testament, one writer's appreciation of the enduring work of others. Like so much of Robinson's writing, the book is alive with questions of kindness, community, and how to express what we so often struggle to put into words. An argument that I make in the book, Robinson says, puckishly implying a counter-argument to contemporary mores, is that God is patient, loves human beings, suspends judgment, and is not inclined toward punitive behaviors. And David starts, to start, I don't think I'm making any great leap in saying that the subject of goodness is something you often write about. I think that's true. Looking around our country right now, goodness and grace and mercy feel in short supply. I wonder if that makes you think any differently about the work that you do or have done. Maybe it makes it feel more urgent. Maybe it feels more difficult. And she says, well, I have to say I'm very surprised, shocked, disillusioned, perhaps, by the turn that things have taken in this country in the last decade or so. The vulgarity and mercilessness that have entered public conversation, and a kind of meagerness and unwillingness to be a source of benefit to the people in the country at large. A stinginess has settled in that's intellectual, economic, very appalling to me, and contrary to any notion that I have of what is good. What do you think we could do about it? We have to rethink some very basic things. Genesis has a lot to do with the way people who claim to be religious understand the nature of God. I think it has in various ways been badly misinterpreted. I think that idea that people can claim the word God often in association with something bizarre, like the word guns, and feel that they've taken the position of righteousness, that's just a terrible corruption of the whole idea of religion. Do you still go to church? Well, I moved. The church of my heart is in Iowa City. They stream their services, and I watch them here in New York. I keep meaning to attach myself to another church, but I just love watching the old faces, hearing the old songs. I've got to get over it. Tell me about participating in your church through streaming. You know, there's a good choir. There's a good sermon. The environment is familiar and reassuring. But there's something about actually going to church the bother involved, that by itself is a huge concession that you make to the meaningfulness of what will happen there. It's a very modest discipline, really. Just, it's too easy to see the service on my computer. You're 80. I'm 80. The clock is ticking. Has what you get out of church changed as you've gotten older? People often comment that a lot of older people are in congregations. And I think it's just partly a fact that the mysteries of existence compound themselves. You always have another question. You mean you're not getting closer to answers? She laughs. No. And David says, that's what I'm banking on. No, my answer is that questions are beautiful. You just think more about life, the brevity of it, the complexity of it, the incredible richness that enters into it accidentally or intentionally. There's something about youth that is wonderful. You really do think you're immortal. Then you find out that there is a shelf life. The date approaches. That shapes your conception of life. It gives it a dramatic arc that is hard to anticipate, so long as your body is not telling you that this is true. Can you tell me more about that arc? One thing I think about is what have you done that actually outlives you? One of the things that you could do would be to enable other people. That's probably the immortality that anyone can hope for. Also, frankly, sometimes I think about what I've missed. I'm a very reclusive person by temperament and choice, but there are lots of interesting people I could have known. David says, people you actually had the opportunity to have known, or are you talking in a more abstract sense? I'm talking quite specifically. Can you tell me? No, I won't tell you. I will not name names. Do you think of your novels as something that might enable their readers? I hope so. I think that my career has been against the grain. I've not chosen subjects or styles or anything that are characteristic of my generation of writers. And whatever else that does, it makes the point that you don't have to go with the grain. People are much freer than they imagine. They'll find often they would come to the workshop. They will find much more latitude if they just use it. Talking to young writers often, they would come to the workshop with the idea that you have to learn one specific style or subject. For them to develop as a writer, what they have to realize is they have a perspective that is theirs and need not be in some coercive relationship with what they take to be cultural expectations. There's a sidebar that says, 2016, Robinson retired after 25 years of teaching creative writing at the Iowa Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa, where she remains a professor emeritus. David says, I do mean to challenge you a little. Have at it. The idea that we're freer than we'd led to believe, I'm thinking of that in light of much more scrutiny about the choices artists make and what they represent and the language they use and their stance toward their subjects. You think we have more leeway than we might believe? A lot of freedom is curtailed by people assuming that their freedom is curtailed. I hear people saying, I wouldn't dare say that. Someone might object. That's how tyrannies operate. Artists and writers have, during my whole life, presented themselves as if they were flying in the face of bourgeoisie expectation. That's the black turtleneck of the whole thing. And here they are, perhaps flying in the face of somebody's expectations, and they act as if they had to be intimidated by that, as if they have to mold their behavior around it. If, for the first time in my life, it's actually true that there is some risk involved in being contrarian, well, take the risk. That's the point. David says, it does require a degree of courage. So? Who decided we shouldn't have courage? That kind of appalls me to think that people need not expect that of themselves. You referred to moral deficits in the country. At the same time, in our day-to-day lives, we encounter so much goodness. Why does that seem absent from how we think about our social life together? That's a very profound question. I worry about the country at the same time that I'm aware, day-to-day, of how much I've benefited from kindness and honesty and consideration. you so rarely have a really bad experience, and you hope other people have a good experience of you. But some idea has swept the country that to say that people are good is naive. It's as if we're all supposed to be cynical, even though, as you say, many of us have excellent grounds not to be cynical at all. It's a mannerism. It's a pose. It's perhaps more characteristic of privileged people than of people who really might wonder about justice and mercy. It's terrible to say that a great civilization could collapse from the force of a fad, but sometimes I feel as if that's what's happening. That cynicism is not totally unfounded. The distinction has to be made between skepticism and cynicism. Cynicism is a dead end. Skepticism is always justified. I know that during Obama's presidency, you became friendly acquaintances with him and discussed some of these issues. Have you continued that discussion with him since he left office? No, I haven't. And it's my fault. That's one of those things I regret. For years, I wrote letters to him consistently, and he wrote back to me, and it was wonderful. I don't know what it is. I stopped writing the letters. I apologized to him a million times over. He's done me every kindness that he could possibly do. What might you put in a letter to him today? Say something to cheer me up? He has this wonderful optimism about the American people. We've had years of bad experiences, and I'd like to know what he sees now. I know he would say that the people ultimately are wise, that the people ultimately are good. Obama's been making podcasts and films. There's a sidebar. Barack and Michelle Obama's Higher Ground production company has produced films like the apocalyptic thriller Leave the World Behind and the biopic Rustin, as well as podcasts like the Michelle Obama podcast and Renegades, Born in the USA, which was hosted by Barack Obama and Bruce Springsteen. David continues, I wonder if that says something about America and aspirations. This man who has exceedingly rare political gifts and exceedingly rare symbolic power, even this guy wanted to go to Hollywood and make content. I find that a little dispiriting. Well, I think that's partly why I didn't know how to speak to him anymore. It was like he chose to step into another kind of life that's very remote to mine. Myself, I like books, but probably film is the quintessential art of this period of time, and I don't want to be dismissive about it. It's just not my world. What's the last movie you saw? Gee, I don't know. I tried to watch Barbie, but it stopped in the middle. I didn't deal with the problem. What did you think of the parts you saw? It was not addressed to me, let's say that. If pink by itself is a toxin, I think that was the effect that it had on me. I mentioned your age earlier. Do you find yourself thinking about heaven more as you get older? Well, I belong to a particular branch of Protestantism. Robinson is strongly influenced by Calvinism. That sort of discourages reflections on heaven in the sense that we can't know what it is and we can't know on what grounds we might or might not end up there. I find that very satisfying. What it does is entirely refocus attention to the world. When I die, I expect to be very impressed with what follows. Are there still fundamental theological questions that you have? Or maybe more simply, what doubt do you have? My theological question is how to reconcile the cruelty of the world with the idea of God's omnipotence. And I simply assume that's something I will not understand in this life. And David says, hearing you say that, I'm embarrassing myself, but it's going to compel a confession from me. One real motivation for why I wanted to talk to you is that there are experiences of transcendence that you write about in your books that connect people to God or the divine. I feel as if I have transcended experiences, being in my train ride into Midtown Manhattan and seeing an egret in the water of industrial New Jersey, listening to a song and being blown away that people can create that beauty. Experience the goodness of my family, any number of things. And I was raised with some religious instruction. I had a bar mitzvah. Half of my family's Catholic. But for whatever reason, my heart cannot osmosize religious feeling. What am I missing? Maybe nothing. Perhaps when you say the word God for yourself, the conception that you have is something that's foreign to your own higher experience. So trust your experience. There's a holiness in the fact that people are living in the world in a way that makes them feel that the world is addressed to them. And I think that's much closer to the divine, much closer to religion, than the idea of trying to bring the idea of God, which has been abused historically, into the frame that your expectations may create for that figure. David, well, there's a couple of lines from your novel, Gilead, that if people were to take them seriously, would go a long way toward what you're talking about. Wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration. You don't have to bring a thing to it except a little willingness to see. Only who could have the courage to see it? How might people find that courage? I wish that people would do things of beauty and benevolence. When I was teaching at the workshop, we would get a good variety of students, a lot of whom came from difficult backgrounds. And in order to make it through all the hurdles to graduate school, they were probably assisted by individuals or mechanisms at various points, and then they come and they're brilliant. I hate to use economic language, but in a sense, we're creating value for the culture in other human beings, in the degree that we're generous toward them, in the degree that we are made hopeful by their gifts. To the extent that we step out of these stupid competitive models that we set for ourselves and realize that our well-being is something that is achieved collectively by encouraging other people to do beautiful things, not putting them in situations of grinding lack and resentment that then becomes the argument against the social order and against democracy. I realize, David says, I realize I've been talking to you as if you're the oracle from the Matrix. I wonder if I can ask you something a little earthier. What do you do that's bad? Do you steal ketchup packets? How do you get into trouble? It's not a fair question because I don't like ketchup. To get into trouble, I procrastinate like crazy, almost in proportion to the seriousness of the demand that's being made of me. This is a terrible thing. I hate to think what all I might have neglected in the course of my life. I live by myself, surrounded by books, and I don't even have a cat anymore. So there's very little harm I can do. In other words, I consider myself to be untested in many ways. Fine by me. That's a pleasant life. David, I have no remedy, I have no remotely smooth segue to the next question. I have a theory about the lapsing of your relationship with Obama. You said that you felt as though you didn't know how to speak to him anymore. It suggests to me that you saw him as a kind of avatar of American democracy. Then when he left office and was in the world of multi-million dollar book deals and Hollywood deals, that wasn't something that you could connect with symbolically. And that's why you felt like you couldn't talk to him. Does that seem plausible as a theory of relationship between two people I know nothing about? I think it's pretty descriptive, actually. My admiration for him is very great, and I'm sure that he's doing things of real value. And by not finding an imaginative way into that, it's certainly no less than positive judgment. I think he stepped back because he doesn't want to be seen as a competitor with President Biden. Because Obama's signature quality was youth, and Biden's is age. Frankly, I'm less than a year younger than Joe Biden, so I believe utterly in his competence, his brilliance, his worldview. I really do. You have to live to be 80 to find this out. Anybody under 50 feels they're in a position to condescend to you. You get boxed into this position where people who deal with you are making assumptions about your intellect. It's very disturbing. Most people my age are just fine. What can I say? It's a kind of good fortune that America is categorically incapable of accepting that someone with a strong institutional memory, who knows how things are supposed to work, who is habituated to their appropriate functioning, is president. I consider them a gift of God, all 81 years of them. I think you should write a letter to Obama tomorrow. I should. He's gone gray, you know. Don't condescend. I don't think I've ever been guilty of that where he was concerned. Can you leave me with a line of scripture? God is faithful. That's my favorite. Now I'll read the Screenland section of the magazine. Tubi, that's T-U-B-I, is reviving a lost joy watching really, really bad movies. Their films have gone viral for their awful production values, but their success says fascinating things about what comes after prestige TV. This is an article by Neela Orr. There's a 2008 movie that offers an odd preview of today's entertainment. In Michel Gondry's Be Kind, Rewind, a bizarre accident demagnetizes the entire inventory of a video rental store. So a clerk and his eccentric friend decide to remake all the films themselves, from The Lion King to Driving Miss Daisy to 2001 A Space Odyssey. Their versions are 20 minutes long, at most, shot on an old handheld video camera, and produced in a delightfully quirky, ad hoc way. Handcrafted props and sets, buddies working as extras, costumes from the local dry cleaner. They call their tapes sweeted, explaining the time it takes to supply films by claiming the copies have to be imported from Scandinavia. In Gondry's fantasy, the community responds well to their homespun cinema. Not only does demand go up, but store patrons begin to participate in making the movies. Gondry's theory, he said, was that people would enjoy films better if they shot them themselves. 16 years later, that democratic spirit is alive on Tubi, the cult hit streaming platform that has become a social media phenomenon. Tubi's library includes plenty of conventional Hollywood productions, but the company may be best known for its selection of Z-movies, films characterized by outrageously low-budget aesthetics, short run times, horrible acting, and worse special effects. The archetypal Tubi movie is like a sweeted tape without the charm or whimsy. The style recalls a host of beloved filmmaking traditions. Slasher films, midnight movies, lifetime dramas, stilted 1970 erotica, poorly dubbed martial arts flicks, Nigeria's Nollywood thrillers, Tyler Perry's videotape stage plays, insipid director-to-video filler. But boy, are they fun to watch. So deliriously bad, they're good. Tubi offers schlocky movies of all types, horror, disaster, holiday, rom-com, but the kind that has captivated audiences is something like the self-published urban fiction crime novels of the early aughts. The director, Silk White's All I Want Is You Two, is perhaps the most infamous, owing to a clip that lit up social media. 62 minutes long, the film stars a former Real Housewife of Atlanta, Claudia Jordan, as Chloe. In the scene that went viral, Chloe, having just gotten out of prison, goes to the home of her old boyfriend, only to discover that he has since partnered with his former parole officer and fathered a young daughter. At the climax of this confrontation, Chloe produces a gun, from where is hilariously unclear, and shoots her ex and his new woman amid canned Foley sounds and a post-production visual cloud like something out of a fake Stan Brakhage animation. The daughter, having just watched her parents' murders, trills that she's just a kid and raises her hands in front of her face. A schmaltzy score emphasizes the emotional stakes. Chloe hesitates. No, you think. In a time of extreme gun violence and school shootings, surely they'll not depict this protagonist straight up icing a kindergartner. But then Chloe does, and it's a testament to just how cartoonishly bad and unreal these movies are, how unseriously you take them, that as fake gun smoke hovers above a dead kid's head, the only possible reaction is to laugh. Whatever financial resources these directors lack, they make up for it in gall. Flaws are so brazen that you wonder if the filmmakers are advancing some kind of theater of the absurd, high art, narrative deconstruction. Only on Tubi do actors fail at pantomiming basic human behavior. In Vicki Gladney's My Father's Keeper, a black couple's new twins are represented by what are very clearly white baby dolls, even in close-ups. Perhaps the genes for skin tone and matte finish were recessive. The second of three The Stepmother films, a Tubi original directed by Chris Stokes, features a flabbergasting continuity error in which the actor playing a security guard changes multiple times in one scene, despite one actor's having a short afro and the other's wearing beads. In the series Coming Out, a woman hits a young man with a frying pan in the manner that Wile E. Coyote might drop an anvil. My favorite feature, To Love the Soul of a Woman, incorporates blood spatter that looks like digitized ketchup and a flashback scene to a Bosnian war zone that appears as if it were shot in an Atlanta municipal park, and features a guerrilla assailant played by a black woman in fresh braids. If you watch only one Tubi clip, please let it be the one that follows the improbable path of a bullet, which hits a tree with enough force to slump a woman hiding on the other side. These moments turn out in the social media era to be the best promo such films could hope for. Gladney, the director of My Father's Keeper, once joined a thread of TikTok commenters castigating her film. It was COVID, y'all. My first film, writer, director, and producer. Show me some love. In a way, people have, by sharing the clip online, even if the posts are soundtracked by uproarious laughter. Tubi, which debuted in 2014 and was purchased by Fox in 2020 for $440 million, has surged in popularity since the pandemic. Gaff-rich projects certainly haven't held the service back. In January 2021, Tubi had 33 million active users. By February 2023, that had gone up to 64 million, and by September, it was 74 million. It's a complicated feeling whenever you see a corporation thriving based on the thrifty ingenuity of black creators. Think of 1970s blaxploitation films or the role of black users in popularizing platforms like Twitter and TikTok or the whole history of the music business. Is this a kind of populist creativity finding a way into the world or just a business exploiting an underserved audience to pump out cheap content? Are these movies furthering black representation in their own oddball ways or embarrassing us with lowbrow cliches? Is Tubi fostering a kind of American Nollywood? Is this what independent filmmaking will look like now that even Sofia Coppola says she struggles to raise money for her work? Still, despite its trashy peculiarities, Tubi is a refreshing antidote to the homogenization of streaming platforms and the formulaic awards bait that marks the decline of prestige TV. It resurrects a viewing habit from the past, tuning into weird late-night stuff you were surprised to find on marginal cable channels or the back shelves of video stores. 2024, it's hard to stumble across anything as truly unusual as Superstar, The Karen Carpenter Story, or The Room, or Leprechaun, or Ganja and Hess. Patubi conjures the curiosities of a pre-streaming world, the languorous strangeness of cable access, or Len Sella's moron movies on The Tonight Show, or Z Channel or Trio, that hub of the discarded and the avant-garde. During the pandemic, comfort viewing became a major mode of media consumption. There's tremendous comfort in laughing at Tubi movies. They are feature-length blooper reels, moving spot-the-difference pictures. Viewers watch with red pens out, talking at the screen, making their own versions of Mystery Science Theater 3000. As in Gondry's vision, the movies invite participation. Their cheapness suggests anyone could be a filmmaker, just as anyone could find a following ridiculing them online. In the Tubi universe, everything is ecstatically off. These films don't allow you to suspend your disbelief. If anything, they require disbelief to fully enjoy. They are post-prestige, post-quality, post-taste, and a glorious relief from a post-decorum America. Their cinematic world is as askew as the actual world often feels. But on Tubi, that estrangement seems fun, not frightening, because on Tubi, you can, eventually, turn it all off. And now I'll read another letter of recommendation. Listening to music is better when it's a conversation among friends. At group listening sessions, everybody gets a turn to speak by choosing a song. This is a story by Tim Davis. If you are the type of person who bides your time waiting for any conversation to pivot to music, who scrabbles through the dollar record bins of junk shops, or mudlarks around the streaming playlists of your favorite musician hunting for rarities, you might be a golden ear. That's golden ear capitalized with G and E. You almost certainly love music, but odds are you are listening to it alone. The golden ears are devoted to listening to music together. Most weeks we gather in Tivoli, a little hamlet on the Hudson, to share songs. It began about 15 years ago after a few music-minded friends moved up from the city. We schlepped book bags of precious vinyl and congregated around our hi-fi stereos. There would be casual chit-chat, but once the needle descended, we would listen quietly to the end of each person's carefully chosen song. This shared attentiveness, being social without talking, an intimate act usually reserved for married couples and Zen monks, felt precious. A surprising focus replaced the pressure to make conversation, like a shooting star silencing a cookout. At one of our first sessions, someone laid down a 45 revolution per minute RPM record of Doris Troy's What You Gonna Do About It? 1 minute and 52 seconds of the purest pulsing promise of American music, a jaunty, saucy, sashaying tiptoe of soul, almost impossible to not do the monkey to. When it ended, cheers erupted. Certain norms have materialized. There's no set time limit between songs, and who gets to play what next is an open question, unless a member we call the proctor is present, when a consistent order must be followed. Tracks are generally short, 5 minutes or less. No genre is verboten. Themes, songs about songwriting, Beatles adjacency, songs you want played at your funeral, emerge or don't. Bold provocations and sometimes prompts have led to an evolving nomenclature. For example, the Sanborn is the spinning of a song by an artist no one has heard of, while everyone pens a one-line review. There's plenty to exhort and lots of talk between songs. For golden ears, talking about music is a sacred chance to kibitz over what we've stumbled upon in obtuse liner notes or an out-of-print autobiography. The pandemic was very hard on us. Of all the aloneness the pandemic spawned, no longer listening with my friends was among the hardest. Once Dr. Fauci said we could, we went outside with Bluetooth speakers. Not wanting to bother anyone, we set up a fire pit deep in the woods and strung up lights. The first song we played there was Count Basie's Lil Darlin', a tune so confident and leisurely that it felt as if Basie himself were leaning down from the bandstand, telling us in that dark moment that everything would be all right. We named the clearing after the song, and the music we play there trends toward emotional and contemplative uplift. Sitting by the fire after one of these gorgeous plays, someone will often break the silence with a sly, "Sorry, officer," imagining a state trooper showing up to find a ring of middle-aged adults in Adirondack chairs listening to Jimmy Guifi. For almost 4 years, we've assembled there through snow and summer cicadas, listening to exquisite music accompanied by caroling coyotes. There have been changes. Being outdoors meant embracing Spotify over record players, and playing music from our phones brought new possibilities and pitfalls. No one looking at their phone is actually listening to anyone or anything, so we have regulated phone use to the period when the next player is searching for a song. For lifetime record scroungers, switching to streaming services at first felt gravity-less. There's too much choice. But being able to improvise responses to one another's songs in the moment from a vast grab bag of recorded music made the game of collective listening more playful. At the official Lil Darlin' streaming playlist expands, it is currently over 127 hours long, and we have had to quest further afield to discover unexpected nuggets. We find ourselves freed from the tyranny of our own taste. One autumn night, I played a ridiculously funny and funky song from 1979 called Answering Machine, in which a desperate lover has his voicemail marriage proposal cut off by an answering machine beep. It's by Rupert Holmes, the crafty songsmith mostly known for a similar sonic rom-com about placing a personal ad. Holmes once said, "I have a feeling that if I saved an entire orphanage from a fire and carried the last child out on my shoulders, as I stood there charred and smoking, they'd say, 'Aren't you the guy who wrote that Pina Colada song?'" Answering Machine is not cool. It's somehow both overly sincere and too clever. I wasn't worried that I might offend the golden ear's impeccable taste, though. By now we're used to listening to music for one another in a way that privileges adventure over taste. The professor brings in pop-punk masterpieces and the obscurities of musical theater. The proctor favors funky grooves and tone poems. The Turk arrives with Mediterranean treats and eccentric time signatures. Shazam loves Duke Ellington and Blue Eyed Soul. Doodles is a curator of beatnik obscurities. I count on their open-eared acuity. Having a listening group as a sounding board of directors turns the sprawl of music history into a rolling conversation with friends, a renewable resource, an endless delight. Tim Davis is a photographer and associate professor of photography at Bard College. I'm going to read another letter of recommendation. "I never bought anything from QVC. I can't stop watching it. The playful pleasures of David Venable keep pulling me back in." This is a story by Hal Sunt. "Last fall, I lived in a hotel, a small college town where I teach, an admittedly strange arrangement that came from a serendipitous perk, cable TV. At the end of most days, after stocking up on ice from the machine down the hall, I would get beneath the sheets and click on QVC. If I was lucky, I got to watch the incomparable David Venable, whose most distinct trait, aside from his striking height, 6'6", and the dulcet tones of his North Carolina drawl, is his happy dance, a hands-over-head, 360-degree twirl that he executes when a product especially delights him. In seemingly every moment of his cooking and houseware show in the kitchen with David, he radiates joie de vivre. I don't think I'm part of Venable's target demographic. I can't cook. I don't like accumulating things. I appreciate when a living space feels homey, but I'm just as content in a spare room as I am in a curated one. Still, I've become one of many David Venable's faithfuls. Regardless of what he's selling, I'm watching. Venable avoids falling into the wolfish smarm that typifies the shopping show genre. There's a forthrightness of approach that tells us he's interested in more than just selling things to us. When he's talking up a portable power station, warning us that we won't know we'll need it until it's too late, he's not being a doomer. He's being honest. He comes off like a mindful parent cautioning a naive child, much like my folks, who, when I was in high school, always made sure I had an extra coat and blanket in the car during Minnesota's brutal winters, just in case my car broke down. Like any salesperson, Venable uses scarcity as a tactic, but he doesn't promise that any particular item will solve all your problems. Rather, he imagines a life for the viewer already brimming with warmth. Whatever he's selling could make that full life a bit less unwieldy. You might feel compelled to buy those airtight, spill-proof, lock-and-lock storage containers, not just because they're selling out fast and this deal will only last tonight, but also because With Venable's encouragement, you can imagine walking to your parents' home, holding your child's hand, juggling a stack of gifts, and laughing so hard you might drop your homemade hot dish on your way to the front door. With Lock and Lock's proprietary technology, however, you can be confident that your casserole won't spill. For me, In the Kitchen with David functions as therapeutic entertainment. Venable's screen presence never activates anything in the realm of stress or embarrassment. Just like us, we learn. He drops dishes at home, and his kitchen goes through various states of disarray. There's no shame in your game if you go to the store or bakery and you buy something store-bought and put it in there, Venable will say while holding a pie carrier with handle lid. His non-judgmental energy transforms solo TV watching into a communal experience, inviting us to marvel alongside him at the quotidian, a non-stick pan, or a vegetable wedger, or a sugar-free caramels. And he is never desperate to make a sale. Look closely as a jittery brand ambassador fumbles over his or her pitch, and you'll see Venable's eyes soften and a smile spread across his face. He seems to enjoy it when things don't go as planned. For him, spills, mispronunciations are not reasons to panic, but opportunities to play. Perhaps Venable's most impressive attribute is his sheer endurance. Tune into the opening or final moments of a show, and Venable's cadence and enthusiasm are identically amped despite the fact that there are no commercial breaks. For the uninitiated, the suspense of any given episode of In the Kitchen with David is minimal. The seasoned viewer, however, watches eagerly to see if Venable will reward the vendor with his happy dance, which has been shown to actually increase sales, QVC's equivalent of a big play in live sports. Lately, I've been most entertained by the show's quieter moments, when an everyday item or otherwise throwaway banter elicits an unexpected response from Venable. One Wednesday night in January, I tuned in to In the Kitchen with David and happened upon a big night, the 25th anniversary of Lock and Locks selling its storage containers on the network. I say this not to pressure you, Venable apprised the audience of the rate at which Lock and Lock was selling out. It's just good information. Earlier in the broadcast, a representative from the Wisconsin wholesale food distributor Family Farms was promoting a 14-ounce bacon-wrapped stuffed chicken breasts. The rep demonstrated the chicken's succulence by squishing it with a knife until melted cheese oozed out and juices streamed down the tender white meat. Venable struggled to find the word to describe what all that juiciness meant for the viewer. He tried renders, as in, as the fat renders down, where does that juiciness go? Into the chicken. But the description didn't quite fit. The rep chimed in, it just gets absorbed all in there. Absorbed. Venable echoed, clenching his fist as he grasped the word's sublimity. 16 minutes into a 2-hour show, and with still much to sell, Venable paused to revel in that word, perfect in its clarity and precision. He gave the Family Farms rep 4 gracious taps of approval on the shoulder, then looked past the camera, repeating softly, as if just for himself, absorbed is a good word. Hal Sunt, the author, is a writer from Minnesota. His first book is Warplane, How the Military Reformers Birthed the A-10 Warthog, Lions Press, 2023. And now another article from the Times. Chip by chip, this ice cream flavor is melting away. Chocolate chip ice cream, once a year-round staple, has fallen out of favor. There's a picture of a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 scoop ice cream cone. This is a story by Matt Richtel. Banana pudding, chocolate fudge brownie, salted caramel, cherry Garcia, Dr. Pepper float, and dozens of other flavors packed the ice cream freezer at a local Safeway. Robin Sawyer, one recent Sunday afternoon, hunted for her personal favorite, black raspberry chocolate chunk. Her husband, Mark, 68, has long been a fan of chocolate chip, but he doesn't see it around much anymore. Here it is, Ms. Sawyer, 66, said to him, kneeling in front of the Haagen-Dazs section, in the small container. Then she corrected herself, oh, that's chocolate chip. Vanilla chocolate chip ice cream, once a staple of the ice cream world and one of the top sellers of all time, has fallen out of favor. The flavor can still be found, a closer inspection of the Safeway aisle in this university mountain town revealed pints of Baskin-Robbins chocolate chip. But it's been losing ground to flavors with more stuff like cookies and cream and chocolate chip cookie dough. Those two flavors are among the nation's top 5 bestsellers, according to the International Dairy Foods Association, while chocolate chip no longer makes the top 10. It's now sold only in selected markets and at certain times of the year, according to major manufacturers. Chocolate chip used to be a flavor we produced constantly, said Carolyn Crowley, communications specialist for Babcock Dairy Plant, which has 75 years of ice cream making under its belt in Madison, Wisconsin. Chocolate chip hasn't been a staple for a decade, she said. Now it's seasonal, meaning made for summer only. Even then, chocolate chip is not such a hot seller. Last summer, Babcock took 4.5 months to sell through the 110 gallons of chocolate chip it had made, compared to 3 months for the same amount of chocolate chip cookie dough. It's kind of not fair, Ms. Crowley said of the comparison, we stock a chocolate chip cookie dough all year, giving it such an edge that it's creeping up on vanilla in popularity. The reasons for chocolate chip slide aren't exactly clear. Ice cream tastes change, as they always have, and there are more choices than ever in every category. Bluebell Creameries, based in Texas, took a few days to get back to a Times reporter's question about the changing fortunes of chocolate chip ice cream, but there was a good reason. We released a new flavor, cinnamon twist ice cream, to consumers this week, so it's been a crazy past few days for our team, read a vanilla email from the Bluebell public relations team. The company had chocolate chip as a staple until the early 2000s, Bluebell said in its email. But with growing demand for flavors like cookies and cream, chocolate chip has become a market-specific flavor based on consumer preferences. The company's email said, white chocolate chip may not be a standard flavor in our ice cream lineup. There are still many fans in our markets that can't get enough of it. Joe Merck, 39, can't get enough of it. He came to the Safeway aisle in search of a different Bluebell flavor, Cookie Two-Step, which he described as having chocolate chip cookie dough filling, but based on cookie dough ice cream. It became an instant hit when introduced in 2016, according to Bluebell. Mr. Merck used to like regular old chocolate chip ice cream, he said, but it's not here. Even if the flavor were available, he wouldn't gravitate to it. Cookie Two-Step is my jam. To some ice cream experts, chocolate chip feels plain. It's not the worst, but it's not that good, said Annie Ward, 8, standing in the frozen food aisle. To be fair, she could not remember the last time she had chocolate chip ice cream. Her father, Sean Ward, reminded her that the flavor involves vanilla ice cream with chocolate chips. It's similar to cookies and cream, she said, but no cookies in it, he said. Mr. Ward said that when he was growing up in Ohio in the 1980s and early 90s, there were not as many ice cream choices. There's a whole aisle now, he said. Every time I go over there, I'm like, what am I buying now? Tillamook, a major ice cream maker based in Oregon, noted that vanilla's fortunes have slid too. According to industry data, sales of vanilla ice cream dipped 6.4% in volume from 2018 to 2022, compared with a 22% decline for chocolate chip, while volume sales of cookies and cream rose 72.6%. Austin Blythe, a publicist for Tillamook, noted that the company had deepened its flavor bench recently, adding brownie batter, chocolate hazelnut, German chocolate cake, and yes, a dark chocolate cookies and cream. Mr. Sawyer in the Safeway aisle with his wife has largely forsaken chocolate chip ice cream for other flavors. I now eat vanilla, he said. It goes well with rum. He did offer a close approximation. Stracciatella, which is vanilla with chocolate flakes. But it's gelato, Mr. Sawyer said. He seemed to feel sorry for the Times reporter who had come to the grocery store and visited various ice cream shops in search of his beloved chocolate chip flavor and owned up to his investigations into why he couldn't find any. Mr. Sawyer again pressed the gelato option while noting it wasn't a simple solution. You have to go to Italy. And I'll end with Judge John Hodgman on the husband who loves to vacuum. His weird hobby is unsettling to his family. Jen writes, my husband, Rob, loves to vacuum floors and does so several times each week. Afterward, he brings the machine to the center of the home to announce what he's captured. It's disgusting. By the time he lifts hair, nail clippings, and dried dog snot, I have fled the room. Please order him to stop. And the judge writes, be grateful. Not everyone's spouse's weird hobby actually gets the house clean rather than filling up its corners, say, with home brewing kits, exotic birds, or old plastic bags full of yarn. But that doesn't give Rob the right to nauseate you. It's fine for him to unpack his dirt tube and examine his discoveries, but he should keep that part of his pastime where it belongs, on YouTube, where I'm confident he will find a legion of fans eager to witness his gross unboxings. Call the channel Rob Sucks. You're welcome for all the money. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.